I want to be and I want to live otherwise. I want to be in a stream of endless and almost effortless possibility. I want to move towards the dark and the light at the same time, and the possibilities of the contradictions of those things and how they relate and meld together.
Welcome to our Weltkunst podcast, Was macht die Kunst? What is art up to? And welcome, Adam Pendleton.
Thank you.
I'm really delighted to be here, to see your wonderful exhibition, and to be in this spot at the Tankstelle Pace Gallery Berlin, this place that was transformed a few years ago by Jörg Judin, who made out of a gas station this wonderful garden with bamboo, and we hear a water fountain. We are recording this podcast as a live podcast, so to all our listeners later, if you hear a motorcycle going by or the fountain sprinkling in the background, that is the live atmosphere here at Tankstelle Berlin. The occasion is your exhibition, Spray, Light, Layer, Emerge. We will talk about it. Some of you may have seen it already on both floors of the gallery here next to us. And we are very grateful to our partner, Volkswagen Group Culture, for making this podcast possible. So Adam Pendleton, an amazing artist, a painter, a very important figure in contemporary American painting today. You have shown at MoMA in New York, you have shown at Palais de Tokyo in Paris, you have shown at MUMOC in Vienna, and many museums have bought your work. There's a big exhibition right now in the Hirshhorn Museum in Washington that's going for another more than a year through the beginning of 2027. What is art up to? That's the question. Was macht die Kunst?
I think art is up to what it's always up to, and that is it's reinventing itself with purpose, with dignity, with a kind of confusion, but also clarity about the past, the future, and of course, our present moment.
So how can we imagine your studio and your workday in New York? How do you start a day? When do you start a day? How do you get to your studio? What does it look like?
That's such a nice question. Thank you.
We go easy in the beginning.
So let's see. So I start my days on the early side. So I probably wake up sometime between 5:30 and 6:30 a.m. And I probably have the same bad habit that so many of us do. And I look at my cell phone. You know, maybe I should meditate or have a glass of water, but instead I immediately kind of focus on probably honestly noise and look at email, text messages. And while it's a distraction, it's also a way to kind of begin to orient myself around the things that I need to tackle that day. Depending on the day, I get up, have water, continue to look at email, and then I get dressed, right? We all get dressed. And then I make my way to the studio. And the studio is about a 15-minute walk from my home in Brooklyn.
And what part of town in Brooklyn?
So I live in a relatively tree-lined area called Fort Greene, which is it's a really fantastic neighborhood. It's one of those neighborhoods you live in when you go to other places. You never regret living in Fort Greene. It's really absolutely fantastic. So I walk to an adjacent neighborhood called Clinton Hill, which is where one of my studio spaces is. And I go in, and right at the back of my studio is my office space. So I kind of really walk straight back and sit at my desk and usually open my notebook. I keep a lot of notes. I keep a lot of lists. And I look at those notes. I look at my list. And I begin to orient myself around the different projects that I'm working on. the most important project I'm always working on is the project of painting.
How do you start a painting, and how many works do you work on at the same time? Do you have like various works in an unfinished state around you, or how do you go about to start a work?
The way I approach painting is trying to create a space that is oriented around absolute freedom. And I think that's really important because I think so many aspects of our life are about a kind of control or about a kind of logic or order that is presumed to be sensible or to make a kind of sense. But with painting, I want the absence of sense. I want the absence of control. I really want to dwell in the poetic and theoretical and material possibilities of freedom. So it's a completely liberatory space. How do I manage that? So I have all these sheets of paper on a wall, on two parallel walls in my studio, and I am completely free to make any mark, any gesture that I want to at any given time. And so I'm kind of wildly and freely and with a true sense of abandon developing my own particular visual language. And perhaps this is a slightly dirty word, but my own visual style.
So you have absolute freedom in mind, but you have a lot of techniques that come together. You draw, you take a picture of drawings, you make a silk screen of things. Something looks straight, something looks written, something looks stenciled. How much of a plan do you have before you create a work?
That's where this very interesting tension emerges, is there are these kind of procedural steps that the paintings envelop and involve as they're being made. But the mark making itself is about freedom. And I like that tension between kind of like chaos and control, or control and chaos. So these drawings you're referring to, you can refer to them as works on paper, whatever you want to think, are really the space where I can do anything because, as you mentioned, I photograph those, the gestures that I make on the paper, and then subsequently, I screen print them. So in a way, the paintings are these beautiful documents of all of the acts, gestures, impressions, moments, fleeting and otherwise, that transpire while I am painting in the studio. So the paintings are indexical, and they are full of prospects and possibilities.
One of your series is called Black Dada, and you have these amazing works on the top floor here that are part of this ongoing series. They have, I don't know how many of you saw it already, they have one letter on them that looks very precise, and I was ignorant. I asked, what is the letter for? But it's actually the K, comes from the Black Dada, from the K, and you only use the letters that are in this set of words, Black Dada. So there might be a B or an L, but never a Z. Does it mean you can use, I'm a little bit of a spelling bee addict, I have to confess. Can you use the letters multiple times?
Let's really think about that, right? There are all these rules that are dancing within the space of the painting that I am objectively aware of. And I think the viewer is or becomes subjectively aware of as they encounter the work. It's the very reason why you ask me the question, what is this K? Why is it there? What is this A? Why is it there? What is this D? Why is it there? I want the paintings to facilitate that kind of wonder, that kind of moment of recognition, of not knowing, of kind of reaching for meaning, but also beyond meaning. And there's also just that beautiful moment of looking, right? But if it's, quote, just looking, that's one thing. I want to create a kind of critical atmosphere or environment where you're looking critically, you're looking deeply, you're looking inward, but you're also looking outward at the same time. So this kind of beautiful confluence of sensations.
I'm always amazed how beautiful your words can talk about your art, because not every artist can talk beautifully about their own work. I would like to go back in time and picture you as a little kid. When did you first have an impression from any kind of artwork? And when did you start thinking about it critically? And another attached question, when did you first know that you want to be an artist yourself?
There's so many moments that I remember, so I'll speak to them in a kind of diaristic manner, because they are these fleeting impressions that register in different ways at different times. I remember going to the museum in my hometown of Richmond, Virginia. It was called the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts, and it had quite a good modern and contemporary art collection. Ellsworth Kelly, Saul LeWitt, Andy Warhol, Joseph Beuys, Robert Morris, Gerhard Richter, and major works by these people, quite good examples. And that had to be, I don't know, somewhere between 10 and 12 when I encountered these works and encountered this very productive sense of not knowing, what is this? I mean, now, you know, we go to galleries, we go to museums, and we, you know, there's this kind of ordinariness that evolves over time when you engage either, you know, loosely or passionately with modern contemporary art. But when you're 10, 11, 12 years old, you've never seen anything like it in your life. And I remember that feeling of other, of something being distinctly different. And I think that planted a seed in me from an early age of always having the desire to have that feeling of otherness, of this kind of deep curiosity, of not knowing what something is or how it was made or why it exists. It wasn't a tomato or a watermelon or a glass of water. It was something else, and its sense of purpose, its sense of urgency, I couldn't quite make sense of. And so, yes, I remember that impression quite well. I also remember the first time I saw a Richard Serra exhibition when I was, I don't know, maybe 12, 13 years old at Gagosian Space in Chelsea. And imagine a 12 or 13-year-old seeing a Richard Serra sculpture, again, completely and distinctly different than anything you encounter in your everyday life. I remember encountering language in my mom's poetry books, Adrienne Rich, June Jordan, Audre Lorde. And I remember Adrienne Rich, for example, speaking about her homosexuality and how that was different and other. And I remember at that moment, language being a way to kind of give shape to these notions or these feelings of otherness, of the beauty of difference. And later, I remember when I was 14 or 15 years old, deciding, I am an artist. This is different. This is other. I want to be and I want to live otherwise. I want to be in a stream of endless and almost effortless possibility. I want to move towards the dark and the light at the same time, and the possibilities of the contradictions of those things and how they relate and meld together. So that's how it began.
That's beautiful. You started college early, and you had the chance to go to Pietrasanta in Italy as a young kid. How, that was part of an arts program already, right? How was that for you?
Yes, so I finished high school 2 years early, and then went to Italy when I was 16 to, yes, Pietrasanta, which is not far from Pisa or Florence, for example, and started to engage with a very different side of art, something that was more classical, a different orientation towards history and how forms and formal sensibilities evolve and articulate themselves. So that was, yes, it was an amazing experience.
I studied in Florence for a year when I was an art history student, and I just feel for a young person, let's say the Italian Renaissance leaves such an impression and informs the sensation of proportion and so forth. So I really feel Italy has something super inspiring. You then moved to New York when you were just 18. That is also such a big step for a young person. How was that for you?
On the one hand, it was, I'm trying to think of the right word. I don't want to say it was tough. It was definitely impractical. I think I had $50, and thank God, $50 and a roommate, right? And I drove to New York with my paintings in the back of a U-Haul, which is just like these cars you can rent and lug things around, with my dad. And I, you know, quite frankly, I wouldn't do it again, but I'm so glad I did it.
Were you then still a student, or were you already on your own feet saying, I will make it as an artist?
Well, I had decided I wasn't a student, but I was still very much so a student.
Okay. And it came together really well. You were, you're still a young artist, but it's an amazing array of museum exhibitions you have already had. How would you say, did museums help you on your way? How were you recognized by a museum? Does it go via galleries? How was that path?
I mean, I think who really helped me be on my way was the French dealer, Yvan Lambert. And also before Yvan Lambert were these two young dealers who ran a gallery called Wall Space and actually gave me my first serious show in New York that ended up being reviewed in the New York Times by, I think, a critic whose name we all know, Roberta Smith.
Oh.
And soon after that show, I began a conversation with Yvan Lambert, which started by me going over to him and saying, I'm Adam Pendleton, you should show me. I would not do that today. And he kind of looked at me bemused and confused, but I had known at that time he had just purchased two works for his collection in the south of France. And I think the context of Yvan's gallery was really transformational for me. At that time, he was showing, you know, artists ranging from Nan Golden to Cy Twombly to Anselm Kiefer. So when I started showing with him, I was just 21 years old. So those are, you know, like their work or not, they're giants. They're giants of contemporary art, and for good reason and good measure. And I also remember showing alongside Joan Jonas, who's remains a friend of mine today. And I think being in that company really opened up my mind to all the possibilities of what art can be, what art is, and maybe even more meaningfully, what art can do.
So how would you describe your vocabulary in the last 2 decades that you've been practicing art in New York? How has your vocabulary evolved?
It's evolved in the sense that I would say I have found freedom, and which maybe took 20 some years, over 20 some years. And I am technically utilizing a lot of the same processes, but I'm using them in a way that's, I want to say deeply personal, but not personal in the sense of hermetic, personal in the sense that it is unique to me, and the way or the ways in which it is unique to me, I hope it's universal, that we can all feel and sense that tension again between freedom and control, chaos and control. And I think I'm open to evolving in unexpected ways, not just in the larger context of my work, but also in the specific context of each individual work.
Your big show right now in Washington at the Hirshhorn Museum is reacting to the space, to the architecture, to the Washington Mall. Can you say a little bit about this show? How would you describe it to somebody who hasn't been there?
Yes. That, you know, all shows react to the architecture of the space they're shown in, sometimes better than others. Like this is quite a beautiful gallery here in Berlin. And this was very interesting. I'm going to answer your question about the Hirshhorn. But, you know, I think I had been to this beautiful home gallery many years ago. But this was actually one of the few times I had done a show where I hadn't intentionally gone to the gallery before I began to execute the works for the exhibition. And I'm quite pleased with how it all works here, and this kind of feeling of difference where on the ground floor, you kind of don't know what you're being set up for, so to speak. And then when you do go upstairs, what you encounter is probably not what you expect. So in the case of the Hirshhorn, it's this Gordon Bunshaft building, and it's circular architecture. So one of the things that I'm particularly preoccupied with when I'm composing an exhibition, and I think that's a very important word to kind of let sink in, is to compose an exhibition, is I was trying to create a sense of rhythm in using a circular architecture. And I knew the only way I could do that was by creating these distinct moments of visual difference. And the Hirshhorn show is very purposefully focused on painting. So I think there are 20, 30 some paintings in the exhibition, and one video work, which I also consider to be a painting of and through light and space.
You also reference in your work Resurrection City. That's also part of the Hirshhorn exhibition. I think to most German audiences, it doesn't have a ring to it, but in America, very much so, historically?
No. Nobody knows what it is. No.
Oh, I mean, tell us.
Nobody. I'm sure there are people who know, but it's not the norm.
So Resurrection City has to do with Martin Luther King and 1968. Can you explain to us this historical meaning of these days in Washington?
No, Resurrection City was this unexpected moment where these American citizens set up an ad hoc city on the nation's National Mall in, of course, Washington, D.C. And it had a library, it had a kind of first aid or hospital, so to speak. There were speeches, there were classrooms. And they descended on Washington, D.C. to plea for, demand, and ask for economic and social justice for all Americans. So a group of people who were arguably putting their bodies on their line, or at least involving their bodies in the requests for social in political change. And I think that's just such a beautiful sketch, right, of the kinds of things human beings do sometimes. We can use our bodies to ask for, plea for, demand change. Change for the better, not just for the individual, but for the collective. Better for you, better for me, better for all. And I came across Resurrection City because I saw photographs that were taken by a photographer by the name of Jill Friedman. And I implore everyone to go look up those photos. They're absolutely stunning. And I originally was overwhelmed by them because of their formal qualities, the blacks, the grays, the shadows, the light that she captured. And then subsequently, I began to read about and get an understanding of Resurrection City, which was this kind of beautiful performance, this beautiful political performance that did not last, that was more or less washed away with or by rain. But the impression lasts, the sense of possibility, the sense of hope, a sense of dignity. It's perhaps always present and permanent in some way.
It's beautiful to think that people, when they do a makeshift city like that out of tents and materials that are ephemeral, that one of the things you mentioned is a library. It strengthens my belief in mankind that that's one of the first things you would think of when you make a makeshift institution. And that maybe refers to your poetry too, that the word is such a lasting power that we should celebrate the culture of the word and literature, etc. So how would you say traces of this historical event entered your abstract imagery?
So I began a kind of dirty dance with the images and the video work that utilizes these photographs. They are productively sullied by geometric forms, circles, squares, rectangles, some of the same forms you'll see in the work in different states and different states of existence. And that was my way of kind of having a anachronistic conversation, a formal conversation, a theoretical conversation with perhaps, yes, the ideas of Resurrection City, but at the same time, the formal values and qualities that I was so struck by in Jill Friedman's photographs and her photography.
Now, I would like to ask you a question. I'm sure it's on all our minds all the time, especially when we are scrolling in the morning and reading the latest news. How do you experience the current political climate? I'm also saying that because the Hirshhorn is part of the Smithsonian, right? So we know that someone wants to meddle with culture, also with culture.
Probably not so different than you. Or how do I experience the person? You know, the other show that's up at the Hirshhorn right now is called Revolutions. And it looks at art from about 100-year period, from 1860 to 1960. And so you have Brancusi, Alma Thomas, Joan Mitchell, Barnett Newman, Picasso. And what really sits with me is how certain ideas persist and a sense of possibility persists. So 1860 to 1960, World War I, World War II. And artists persist. The ideas embedded in art persist. They change, they morph, they evolve. But they maintain a kind of urgency. And I think that urgency is embedded in our need, our desire to get a deeper, more holistic and fuller sense of our humanistic potential, our humanistic sense of what is possible to make that deeper and more complete at any given time. And that is what I am dedicated to. And sometimes that is easier, sometimes that is harder or hard, depending on the day, year, month, moment. But I hope I offer that sense of urgency. I hope I offer that need to focus, to be humane, to be engaged with what is human and what makes us who and what we are at any given moment.
Is it possible that abstract art is a little bit of a safe zone? I'm just thinking about the show that Amy Sherald canceled at the Smithsonian just now, working in a figurative style, and obviously a queer person with posing as the Statue of Liberty or Lady Liberty was supposed to not be in the show, and so she canceled the whole show. I feel in terms of imagery, abstract art is more timeless, more open to interpretation maybe, and therefore not immediately focus of any wrath. Do you think so too?
Do you mean why hasn't my show been canceled?
No. I'm saying maybe that's why your show hasn't been canceled. Because, figurative art has a more close reading maybe. Certain themes can be part of your art in abstract ways. And some people just don't get it, you know, and so it's safe.
I understand. Of course, I understand what you're saying. But I don't think something... I think there's something inevitably radical about something being indecipherable, not understood, right? Like, that's kind of where the crisis emerges, in fact, is when things exist in society that are not readily or easily understood. It is, in fact, when things exist in an abstract mode, certain political forces and or institutions become perturbed and disturbed. I don't understand this. I don't understand you. I don't understand that. I don't like it. I don't want it, right? It is that which is queer, right? That which is other is often the most disturbing. If, for whatever strange reason, that is not how it is explicitly playing out in the context of my show in relationship to a different exhibition, I don't think it necessarily, or I don't think it in any way actually, fully contextualizes or speaks to the possibilities of abstraction.
Speaking about your show right here, these abstractions, is there a certain way you expect viewers to see your work? I mean, when I stand in front of the paintings on the second floor, it has a lot of impact. First of all, beautiful. There are these beautiful shapes and materials coming together, and they speak to me, and I'm trying to listen and thinking, what does it do with my memories, with my emotions? Why does this speak to me? And I feel it's very personal. And then again, I'm thinking, how do other people look at it? And what is your aim at communicating with these works? I feel there are certain images, past and present. You see a flash of light. You see something zooming by, like, let's say, being in the subway, in the New York subway. And, you know, sometimes a subway car passes on the other side and you only get a glimpse. You don't really grasp it because it's so fast. It has this speed in a way to it, this ephemeral quality, like a moment that is soon a thing of the past, but then it will haunt you again. So I wonder, is there a certain expectation that you have of the works, how they speak to the viewers?
Well, I certainly hope more people, or most people, have the experience that you did. Thank you. I think it's my my willingness not to be didactic, this, I hope, a kind of intimacy emerges that is unexpected, right? That it's in a way, it's a kind of a love language that I'm offering, I think. And what do I mean by that? It's mercurial and strange. It is like these flashes, these impressions that you can't quite grasp, but yet they're familiar. It's kind of like knowing someone very well, but not knowing them at all. And I think that feeling emerges because some of the things you are encountering are very familiar. The letters, for example, or even just from a material standpoint, they're familiar to you. The canvas, the edge of a canvas, the frame, something being framed and contextualized. But at the same time, it's all very strange. And I think that strangeness is where the dialogue enters with the viewer, of this feeling, this sensation that I'm trying to have a conversation with you. And it's a conversation that can move in many directions at once. It doesn't have to stop. And it also doesn't necessarily have to start in any kind of obvious way. It's a kind of poetics of possibility, but it's also quiet, I hope. And it's also hermetic in the sense that it's private and it's very comfortable and also discomforting. You know, it's again, these perpetual contradictions, and I think they kind of flash, right? And they're also curious. There are all these strange decisions that I'm even all trying to make sense of, you know? There's this sense of things being visible and invisible at the same time, quite literally in the Black Dada paintings, like I'm using a grid, for example, but it's not really obvious that I'm using a grid as a compositional tool or device. So what is happening here? And I think that's why life is interesting, right? Because it's always this kind of question of like, what is happening? Why? What now? What's possible? And we carry on.
If time travel was real, where and to what period would you travel?
I'd like to go back to when Duchamp dreamed up his fountain, when he decided anything could be art.
What's your most important tool?
My hands.
If you were an animal, what would it be?
Well, this week, a big fish. I've become obsessed with the big fish behind us.
What game do you like to play?
I don't think I really like games.
Not even the New York Times spelling bee?
No, I don't like that at all.
Wordle? No? Okay. What's your favorite color?
I don't have a favorite color.
Do you have a recurring dream?
I do, but they're too personal to talk about here.
Do you listen to music when you work?
Yes, but not always.
Can you share which music?
Oh, I listen to all different kinds of things. I think lately I've been listening to an artist named Dijon, Nina Simone, Big Thief.
Our magazine, Weltkunst. What topic would you like to see in an entire issue of Weltkunst?
I love artist studios, so I'd love to see an issue that delves deeply into the difference between artists' studios and how they're set up, organized, thrive.
Can you share wisdom?
Lately, been just thinking a lot about dignity as a kind of operating principle, bestowing dignity to ideas, dignities to a sense of purpose and possibility, and of course, dignity to each other.
Thank you so much, Adam. This has been a great experience talking to you.
Thank you. Much appreciated. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening.